Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone, and today's program is titled The Human Instrument. In it, we are exploring one of music's most commonly used instruments, the solo voice. When we ended part one, we were in the middle of our backstage banter segment, where we were talking with soprano Paula Malone, and she was explaining to us all the different voice categories that there are, beyond just soprano, alto, tenor, bass. It had to do with range, of course, how high and low the voice could sing, tessitura, that is the sweet spot of the voice, where it really sings the best, the timbre of the voice, the tone color, whether it was darker or more bell-like, and the weight of the voice, its power or ability to cut through the sound of an orchestra, and then its agility, how quickly it can move. And so all these things factor into our appreciation of vocal music. Now we're going to go back to that interview, and she's going to tell us some more tips on how to enjoy vocal performances even more.
Now, all these things you've been talking about are really eye-opening, I think, for people who just go to see opera or an oratorio, or they hear a classical voice and they think, oh, that's opera. Of course, that's just a term we throw on everything now that means classical singing. I think this already is going to help. Can you give us any more advice as a voice teacher, as an ambassador for vocal music? Can you give us any advice on how we can enjoy a vocal performance more?
If you're going to an opera that, you know its title, I would learn everything you can about the storyline, the plot, and the composer's style. It's a lot of information coming at you just walking in off the street. I think that's probably the main problem for people experiencing opera the first time, is they don't know what they're seeing. They've never seen anything like this before. It's all in a foreign language. The songs are very long. It's just a lot of information to digest. And so educate yourself a little before you go. You know, don't feel like it's going to spoil the story for you, because it won't. That's not the point of going to opera.
Right. There's no spoiler alerts.
No.
It's all spoiler alerts. You want to know how it ends. You know
right.
how it ends. And so you're watching how the composer treats the story musically
right.
as you're experiencing it,
right? Right. Now, if you're not going to opera, say you're going to a recital and you don't know what is going to be on the program, it's a little bit more difficult to prepare in this. Most recitals will have good notes for you to study, or they will talk from the stage and explain a lot to you, and just, you know, be really keenly aware to try to take as much of that information in as you can, because it will help you to understand what's going on. That being said, I also feel like there should be a visceral emotional attachment in opera or in recital. I mean, if the music's not moving you, then it's just purely academic. Every performer wants to make an emotional contact with their audience. Yes, you're singing in a language you don't understand, possibly, but the composer wrote these beautiful melodies over these gut-wrenching harmonies sometimes, and it's meant to speak to human emotion. And so don't be afraid of that. Let them take you on a roller coaster ride. That's really what it's about. Is just experience the highs and lows of the music itself. People ask me too, like, well, how do I know what good singing is versus bad singing? It all sounds kind of good to me. If you really want to be amazed at watching a pianist, we all watch how fast their fingers moved, and it's really easy to see that and go, wow. But a singer, you know, if they're not singing just high note after high note after high note, it's like, well, who cares? Watch them breathe if you can. That's the good singer. Their chest will not move. All the breathing will be done low in the body, down in, you know, you'll see their belly coming in and out, maybe opening up sideways. But a very good, accomplished singer will have a very stable rib cage. It will not rise or fall. Their shoulders will be open. It will look effortless to them. And that is all great control of breath. And when you see a singer who can do that technically, I submit to you that it will be one of those performances that will be the most emotionally grabbing as well, because they can totally focus on the art.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. We are exploring one of music's most commonly used instruments, the solo voice. We have shown the different types of compositions written for the human instrument during the Renaissance, Baroque, and Classical eras. In the Romantic era, composers were still writing operas and still writing oratorios, churning out a great deal of music for the solo voice. But another genre for the solo voice was rising in popularity among composers, and its growing prominence came about partly because of the rise of the piano as a solo instrument. This new technology was able to produce a lovely singing tone itself, and its pedals added other new possibilities. So as an accompaniment instrument to the human voice, it could add a variety of different kinds of support. This genre of music written for the solo voice was called song, or more commonly referred to now as art song. Now, there were songs being written in the classical era by Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven for the solo voice to be accompanied by that time period's version of the piano. It was just that it became far more popular of a genre during the Romantic era. Part of this had to do with an outburst of lyric poetry that had just happened in Germany, particularly with the Shakespeare of that country, you could say, who had just been on the scene, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Art song in Germany achieved special characteristics in this genre of art song. In fact, when referring to German art song, we typically use the German word for song, Lied, L-I-E-D, or the German word for songs, Lieder, L-I-E-D-E-R, to describe this particular brand of art song. Similarly, song in France took on unique characteristics all its own, so we refer to those songs with the French word for song, chanson. So this genre's rise was partly due to the ubiquity of the piano, the variety of colors and sounds it could produce in accompanying the solo voice, and an outburst of lyric poetry at this time. Now, it's important to note that in song, especially Lieder, the piano was not considered an accompaniment, but an equal partner with the human voice. The piano part would often be written to help illustrate the text, what we call text painting or word painting. Say if the song was about water, the piano might do some descending scales, like in this German art song, Auf dem Wasser zu singen, by Franz Schubert. The piano is imitating Wasser, the German word for water. Here is tenor Ian Bostridge and pianist Julius Drake performing it. Now, eventually, as the Romantic era continued and composers continued to subscribe to the idea that bigger is better, art song, particularly Lieder, started employing the full orchestra to replace the piano. Here is an example of that from a song cycle known as the Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss. A song cycle is a grouping of art songs that share a particular theme or a particular poet. Usually the composer puts these songs together in a cycle. Of course, in the case of Strauss's four last songs, these songs were completed just before his death, and it was someone after his death who noticed the common theme among them, as well as their proximity of composition to his death, and put them together as a four-movement song cycle. The common theme is that of the twilight years of life, depicted metaphorically by the seasons of nature, the time of day, or the idea of going to sleep. Here is Renee Fleming singing a bit of the first song of these four last songs, Frühling, and even though Frühling means spring, it's not about springtime happening right now. It's about someone in winter, in the time of death and cold, looking forward to the blossoming of new life. So that was Renee Fleming with the Houston Symphony Orchestra performing the first of Richard Strauss's four last songs. And that was an example from the end of the Romantic era where the piano in art song was replaced by the orchestra. Now, also in the Romantic era, oratorio and opera were still major elements of the vocal repertoire, except the orchestra was getting huge during this time. So the demands on the singers were greater, as we heard in our backstage banter segment. They needed to have naturally weightier voices in order to cut through and to soar over the huge orchestra and fill these opera halls. And this was before microphones, of course, so it all had to be done with natural acoustic power. At the beginning of this episode, I played an example of a lyric tenor aria from the Italian operatic tradition. It was Pavarotti singing an aria from Giacomo Puccini's Turandot, which used a huge orchestra. But Richard Wagner of the Germanic opera tradition was using an even bigger orchestra. This required, as we just mentioned, those weightier voices. When we think of opera in the stereotypical way, we are usually thinking of the helmeted lady with the double braids and the body armor. And this is from this Wagnerian tradition. Now, not all opera singers sound that way, but these Wagnerian voices do, so that they can cut over the massive orchestra, as was used in this example, in Wagner's 16-hour four-opera set, The Ring of the Nibelung. In terms of oratorio, two major works that continue to be repeatedly performed today from the Romantic era are Felix Mendelssohn's Elijah and Johannes Brahms's A German Requiem. Here is an example from Mendelssohn's Elijah. This is an aria sung by the title character. The title of this aria is It Is Enough. He wants God to let him die. And why I want to play this aria is because the cello is featured in the orchestra as a solo instrument alongside the voice. Many comment on the cello's similarity in timbre to the human voice, and Mendelssohn uses that tone color to complement this baritone voice. So here is Bryn Terfel singing It Is Enough from Mendelssohn's Elijah. Thank you. An example from A German Requiem by Johannes Brahms that uses the solo voice is the gorgeous fifth movement added after Brahms had finished the entire work. He added it because his mother had died, and he wrote this in honor of her. And so here is a soprano singing text from the Bible, saying, "As one whom his own mother comforts, so I will comfort you," God says in this text. So Brahms sets this for a soprano, and here it is sung by the exquisite Montserrat Caballé, singing with the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. This is KPCG. Today we are talking about the human instrument, exploring one of the repertoire's most commonly used instruments, the solo voice. As stated at the beginning of this program, one thing that sets the voice apart from all other instruments is its ability to convey language, text, lyrics. But some composers find great beauty in just the quality of the voice itself, and they write solo vocal music without any text. These kinds of pieces are called vocalises. The most famous vocalise was written by Sergei Rachmaninoff. Here it is performed by soprano Kathleen Battle with pianist Margot Garrett. As we move into our discussion of the 20th century, there's a composition by Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos that makes exquisite use of the solo human instrument. This particular movement is written in what's called that ternary form that we discussed earlier, that three-part form, which is A, B, A, A section, B section, A section. This was a form common to the arias written back in the Baroque era. They are often referred to as da capo arias, meaning that the composer wrote only the first two sections and then made a marking at the end of the second section to da capo, or go back to the beginning and repeat just the first section again. Villa-Lobos does that in this piece because he is paying homage to the Baroque style of music in these sets of pieces. This is the Bachianas Brasileiras, a set of nine works that basically translate to Brazilian Bach, or a tribute to Bach in a Brazilian style, as some have called it. This is the aria from the fifth of these pieces. He calls it Aria Cantilena. So he's giving it a traditional name like aria, and then the Brazilian equivalent, Cantilena. Villa-Lobos said these were not intended to imitate Bach in simply a Brazilian way, but they are Latin American music, quote, inspired by the musical atmosphere of Bach, unquote. So we have here an aria in da capo or ternary form, just as Bach would have typically written in his cantata arias, but it has these Latin American elements. This is most evident in the instrumentation. It's written for eight celli, but some of them are bowing, the traditional Bach way of playing the cello, and some are plucking to imitate the sound of the guitar, a popular instrument in Brazil. The A section is much like a vocalese, no lyrics. The B section contains text. This text is in Portuguese, so that's quite different than what Bach would have used. And then the return of the A section is altered slightly, only in the sense that instead of the singer singing a neutral vowel, as in a vocalese, the singer hums the pitches instead, making an extremely unique effect for the entire last section of this piece. So let's hear this last humming section. This is the aria Cantilena of Bachianas Brasileiras No. 5, performed by René Fleming, with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the New World Symphony.
That was the aria Cantilena from Héctor Villa-Lobos' Bachianas Brasileiras No. 5. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are talking about the human instrument. We are exploring the various repertoire composed for the solo voice. And what we just heard was an example from the modern era, composers using the voice in new ways, not just without text, but using the hums, as we heard there at the end of that aria. Before we wrap things up, I want to move into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. For this segment today, I want to return to our interview with Paula Malone. She teaches on the faculty here at Herbert W. Armstrong College and has taught as an adjunct voice instructor at the University of Central Oklahoma here in Edmond. And we talk today about the best age for training the voice one-on-one.
I'm always excited when anybody is excited about singing and wants to train. However, the first thing I want parents to understand is that singing is music. It is very important that a student coming to want to study voice understand how deep their music knowledge and musicianship needs to become. I will often encourage parents to get their child into piano lessons first, where they can really learn to note read, learn to count, learn to phrase even. Now, the reason we wait a little while to start training voices is because the larynx is not completely mature until after puberty. Therefore, the demands of studying really deep stuff is too much for young children. They can learn posture, they can learn to breathe deeply, and they can learn to read music, and they can have fun. Singing in an operatic or classical style, it's all breath control. And basically, it's breath compression in the lower body and the graduated constant release of the air pressure through the pitch and the tone. That's basically it in a nutshell.
The underlying concept here, the body is the instrument. So there has to be a certain developmental maturity before you can work on what you really, really work on when you're teaching voice.
Definitely. It's not unlike, say, ballet. A good teacher would not let a young child go on point until their bones and their feet are ready to do that, or they could damage their feet for the rest of their lives and never be able to become a dancer. It's the same kind of thing. The mechanism just needs to be matured enough to handle the demands that this art form would put on it.
Where could there be harm done just for those parents out there, you know, wanting to keep their eyes open if they're putting their children in voice lessons? But what would be the harm that could be done?
Well, I don't want to terrify the parents out there. First of all, children are very resilient and they heal very fast. Every time you get laryngitis and every time you're hoarse or you cheered at a ball game, and then, I mean, you're damaging your cords. That's obvious. There is inflammation, there is swelling. Our bodies regenerate and heal very quickly, especially when we're young. And so I tell parents, let them sing, let them have fun. It's okay. It's just they should not do it prolonged. They should not try to sound like an adult. They really should not try to imitate how an adult sounds. And they should just give themselves plenty of time to recoup. Say there's, you know, a bunch of girls together at a party and they're all singing to the radio, having a great time. I did that as a child. I did it with my sister. It was awesome. You've got the microphone in one hand and the air guitar going on. It's awesome. I would never take that away from any young singer's childhood. But don't do it every night. Don't do it outside in the cold. Use some wisdom. Give yourself plenty of rest.
And you're watching for that as a teacher of young students. You're making sure you don't hurt them. You don't ask anything of them that the body just isn't capable of doing yet. Is
exactly.
That right?
If you continually put swelling on your cords, your body will build up what are called nodes on your vocal cords. They're basically like calluses. They're thickenings on the edges of your vocal folds, which is the place that makes your tone. And it will change your voice. It's a bad deal. And you don't want that to happen.
What's the youngest student you've ever started teaching? You know, how old were they? And what did you work on specifically at the beginning?
I believe 13 or 14 for a girl. You have to make sure, again, that puberty is well en route, if not completely done. And you kind of have to look at them. You have to listen to them sing. You have to listen to them talk and understand if they're well enough advanced through this process to begin study. But it's definitely a one-on-one for, I would say, definitely, I would say 16 is a safe age for any girl. And I would say for boys, 18 might be safe. Boys sometimes,
on average,
boys can take longer to mature. But physically, I said there are things that you can do. You just have to be very careful, and you have to not give them material that's going to injure them. And it takes a teacher who has had experience in this and who is even aware that damage can be done.
So we're talking about ages. You obviously, like you said, sang a lot as a child, sang a lot through your teen years. You encourage that. There's certainly all sorts of opportunities for children to do that. When did you actually start one-on-one vocal training?
I started formal training at age 27. So I always tell my students that it's never too late to begin, but it can be too early.
And that is, of course, talking about the actual vocal instruction, talking about the technicalities of tone production, but of course you do encourage them starting early in terms of their musical background, starting with a piano or violin, some sort of instrument that builds those basic fundamental musicianship qualities.
Absolutely. And I recommend that you listen, expose yourself to the art form. That's really my biggest problem right now with even the students that I have. They do not listen to enough classical singing. They listen to the radio. They listen to pop music. Sometimes they may listen to Broadway or to, say, Celtic Women or something like that. And those are all valid art forms, but they are not classical singing. And so they really are at a loss when they're trying to learn the style of the music that I'm trying to teach them. And they need to train their ear for this style, and they need to really engender a love for it. And that can only come through study and listening. There's so many recordings. YouTube did not exist when I was in college. And wow, what a resource it is. You can listen to all the great sopranos who have ever lived during the age of recording just sitting down at a computer. You don't have to buy anything. It's amazing what you can find for free. And just study and listen. Discover the composers you love. Discover the songs you love. Get some idea of what kind of an artist you want to be.
And hopefully this show is introducing you to some of those great, great moments in vocal repertoire and in singing history. Thanks so much, Paula, for your time.
You're welcome.
Listening to Music for Life, I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are talking about the human instrument, exploring one of the repertoire's most commonly used instruments, the solo voice. Finally, let's move into our dessert portion for today. This is where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program, or some lighter classical fare sometimes. Today let's hear something from more of the popular tradition. This is a famous recording of the legendary jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald. It's from her Live in Berlin album, where she encores with an epic rendition of How High the Moon. What's remarkable about this is the extended scat section. We talked at the beginning of this episode about how instrumentalists often try to imitate the human voice. Well, scatting is where the singer uses various random syllables to try to imitate instruments. And you can hear that in this absolutely impressive performance.
So away there's music, how faint the tune. Near, how far, the if you would come to me soon. Until you will, I steal my heart. I hide a moon. I hide a moon. It's the name of the song. I hide a moon. Though the words may be wrong, we're singing it because you asked for it. So we're swinging it just for you. How high the moon? Does it touch the stars? How high the moon? Does it reach up to Mars? Though the words may be wrong to the song. Though the words may be wrong to this song, we are like high, 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 in Idaho. In my eyes, high, 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 high is the moon.
You have been listening to Music for Life from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus. I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.